Welcome to the Off the Page podcast from Franciscan Media. This is part two of our podcast with Franciscan priest and poet, Father Murray Bodo. I highly recommend listening to part one if you have not done so already. Part two picks up after a conversation we had in part one about his journey back to his own heart as a poet, and I then ask him how he got there. This opens things up to a wonderful conversation around creativity and the origins of some of his own poetry. Father Murray is so awesome. Several times it seemed like we were winding down, but then something would be said that would make him think of another poem that he'd then go digging through his books to find, which would then open up more personal stories from his journey. So I did take some liberty with the editing here. No need for you to listen to us flipping through pages or having small talk because we think things are winding down. But the conversations we had here were too special to not include. This was an awesome episode. So I hope it's as encouraging to you as it was for me. And again, here is Father Murray Bodo.
How did you reconnect to your heart? I'm curious. You mentioned you, as you're writing, you had become so critical, kind of stuck in your head.
Yeah.
And then you said something started opening up for you. I think that's a very relatable experience as well. Like, how did you get back to here?
Well, it was an interesting thing. Simultaneously with studying for my doctorate, I was writing poems and short stories because that would be the dissertation.
Yeah.
But I was mining and rewriting poems that I had written before. And there were some new poems there, but I think what happened is I got beyond all I had learned about the craft of poetry, and then the love of poetry took over again.
Mm.
And I was also simultaneously in the afternoons, I was typing the stories of one of our Navajo missionaries about the early years of the friars on the Navajo reservation at that time. And so, you know, I'm dealing with story. I was dealing with stories, and that gave me a better handle on story. It really started to change when I wrote the little book, Juniper, God's Fool, or whatever it's a brother, friend of Francis, Fool of Christ, or whatever. I wrote that book, and all that world of the heart and of the early Franciscan stories came about. And then I was just somehow, I won't say miraculously, but more suddenly than I thought, of that supercritical attitude toward my own writing, and I just let it start coming. At the same time, I had become a friend of the American poet Denise Levertov, whom I met through Song of the Sparrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was teaching her poems, and I got this letter from her that this book meant so much to her. And of course, I was teaching the college seminarians at that time, the young friars, and I knew she didn't write that letter because I was teaching her, opening up her poems for them, and I was trying to figure out for 3 or 4 days which one of them did it. And they would have me answer a letter. But so, you know, after days of torture and I don't know what else I did, but then none of them did it. So I wrote back to her. And we then had a correspondence. And she stayed at our friary with us. And I visited her in her home in Seattle. And so she was the main one that was pulling my poetry out of my head and back into concrete images that would speak better than what I was trying to preach. The kind of heady, when poetry becomes too cerebral,
sure,
it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah. So, well, I appreciate you sharing a little bit about that journey for you, because every poem I've read of yours, I'm truly like amazed of your ability for it to come from here. It's interesting that there was a journey for you.
There was
back to that, and I'm sure that you've had to make that journey back again as well.
Yeah, I did. I had to remake the journey.
Yeah.
And some of it involved as Rilke, the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, in his letters to a young poet, emphasizes, if you don't have anything to say or think you don't, then go back to your childhood. And that's when the poems really began to take on a deeper personal dimension. And I wrote quite a few poems about my childhood. I'm always writing. I'm still writing about my childhood. And because those images are very strong.
Yeah.
But that's, that's part of the discipline. And of course, I'm not in any way putting down my doctoral degree in
sure, yeah,
English, because I mean the geniuses that I was opened up to, that I hadn't maybe just peripherally read. Henry James would be a perfect example. And I've written a couple of poems of being at his home in Rye, Lamb House in England, because it's about a half hour train ride from the Poor Clares that I always make it a point to visit on my way back and forth to Italy. And so he became a huge character in my literary world. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how do I get back into my own inner world. It's too long a poem, but that might be for somewhere else. Poem that I wrote at Rye House, in Rye at Lamb House. But I put a couple of new poems in the new edition that's coming out. Is it this year?
I know I cut you off earlier. Was there another poem you wanted to read, or maybe one of your new?
Well, it was going to be this one, but because it relates to prayer in another way. This other one is very personal, very concentrated on the I in the poem. And this one is a poem quite recently, last year, this year, in my hermitage in Florida. Outside of the hermitage, I got this wonderful bougainvillea bush, and it's eternal. No matter how many times you cut it back, it just gets bigger and better. So this poem, because it's about a sparrow, and the Song of the Sparrow, a sparrow is so, I'm building around this a little bit. A sparrow is so important to me for many reasons, but here it is. In the Song of the Sparrow, I say there is something ragged and unfinished about sparrows. Yet they have always endeared themselves to me. There is something Franciscan about their simplicity, their habit-colored feathers, and their availability when other birds hide away in the woods or fly south for the winter. Of course, now I read that and I say, well, that's me. I'm one of those other birds I go to in the winter to ride in this. But that's why, that was my my reason for, that's part of the play of poetry.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember you see in your own life or whatever. Okay, so this one is called Green Sparrow in the Bougainvillea. I've been sitting a long time under the bougainvillea. So far, nothing has happened. Although a green sparrow did perch briefly among the red leaves, then flew to the feeder to show off his glorious green for me and others who'd seen. Such surprise performances keep me coming back to sit and wait with no agenda. Aimless as it seems, waiting is the deepest kind of prayer. More than birds show up there. So there's something cerebral about this one, but still it's saying more than it's saying. You know, yeah. I've been sitting a long time under the bougainvillea. It used to be a cottonwood tree when I was 7 years old. But I've been sitting under that tree for a long time. So mm-hmm. you make this specific, and it covers a lot of territory. And so far, nothing has happened, or so it seems. Although a green sparrow, which are very rare, of course, perched briefly among the red leaves, all that contrast, then flew to the feeder to show off his glorious green for me and others who'd seen. It's a very tight poem because it's a sonnet, an Italian sonnet, 8 lines and then 6. Such surprise performances keep me coming back to sit and wait with no agenda. Aimless as it seems, waiting is the deepest kind of prayer. More than birds show up there. That's like all those times that I had an agenda and spent most of the prayer on my agenda for God, sure. You know?
Yeah.
And it's all about me or whatever. And there are other times when I'm just sitting, like here, and a green sparrow shows up. I couldn't have thought that up, you know, or made that happen. It was like, it happened because I was there. The same thing we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The dimension of poetry and also journey and also story. Story is very important. And in the new section that I wrote in the that's the wrong book. The song of the sparrow. It begins with journeys, but it's also about story, and I see that's one of the things that an academic another academic degree really made me aware of our stories. We're all stories, and it depends on who's telling them. Who is the narrator? What is the story? And the best way to connect to an experience, I'm talking in terms of art now, is often story. There's a story involved, or there's a backstory that's making this thing click for people. I don't know, this is kind of, but just to show you the difference of when this thing came from. So I'll just read a little bit.
Please, yeah, yeah.
A summer Sunday evening on the Lakeshore Limited from New York City to Cleveland. Oh, that's where I was going, Cleveland. I wonder about. We are passing along the Hudson River at sunset. a red glow on the New Jersey hills across the river as we approach the tip of Manhattan. I pray for loved ones as I watch the broad Hudson flat and smooth at this hour. Like a hammered bronze shield, the river reflects the reddening sky and turns silver as the glow of the setting sun gradually wanes and the gray light of twilight irons out the red tints on the water. We pass Dobbs Ferry just as the sun pops up over a low hill for a few seconds, rouging the water as if for a festive celebration. Swiftly, we pass Irvington. For Washington Irving? The crests of the hills across the Hudson burn as in an Irving tale. The clouds form fantastic shapes. Is Sleepy Hollow Cemetery near? I wonder. And just as I'm thinking these thoughts, we pass Tarrytown. And yes, I murmur, here is Ichabod Crane and Rip Van Winkle and the Headless Horseman. You see how the journey is because I'm paying attention to it?
Yes.
Dark hills now, black with a hint of blue where the remaining twilight breaks through. Idyllic seems an understated word for the magic, that light and shadow, red glow and bronzed river turning to silver, and the memory of reading Irving creates. So what you're seeing related to you to the story, and then you're making your own story. I reach for color, but I have no art with paint and brush. I wish I could reach up to a shelf of Irving works and pull down what his word painted there of black hills and blue as we rush through Ossing, where mallards group like an escutcheon on the burnished shield of a Hudson inlet that will bring us into Croton Harbor. I'm just looking at the planes that come up outside the train. How is it I'm mesmerized here, so far from the New Mexico landscape of my youth? And why is this landscape so congenial, so familiar? Isn't it because it is already inside me, in the words of Irving, who made this landscape a part of my own interior geography through the enchanting power of words like these from the legend of Sleepy Hollow? I'll read them in that. Because this goes on and on, but I'll just give you a little bit of Washington Irving. But so you see, this is meditation.
Yes. Yeah. So
in the bosom of one of those spacious coves which indent the shore of the Hudson, at the broad expansion of the river denominated by the ancient Dutch navigators as the Tappan Zee, and where they always prudently shortened sail and implored the protection of St. Nicholas when they crossed, there lies a small market town or rural port, which by some is called Greensboro, but which is more generally and properly known by the name of Tarrytown. It's all those images of your youth and the stories, and you know, the name was given, we are told, in former days by the good housewives of the adjacent country. I wonder if that's supposed to be county. Oh my, we already sent the book in, didn't we?
But we may have found that one, actually.
You did?
I think the proofreader may have found that.
Oh,
one.
Wonderful.
Because it sounds
the
familiar.
Yeah. Of the ancient county, yeah. From the inveterate propensity of their husbands to linger about the village tavern on market days. So as I read that, and read the beginning of the book, this writing is much more sophisticated than when I first started writing in 1976. Mm. And so, and a lot of that has come from my academic, richening of my academic background. Mm. And but it becomes part of then of who I am. And yeah. So
well, one of my favorite things about that poem is you said it earlier. It's one moment.
Yeah.
It's one moment that you're gazing upon. And yet, because you're allowing yourself to become vulnerable to that moment.
Yeah.
All these things are opening up within, you know, yeah. stories from your youth. Things yeah. that are already ingrained within you that you didn't realize were ingrained within you until you're seeing this scene. And I mean, that's such a beautiful thing about poetry, and your poetry in particular, is it, and that's prayer too, right? It's like, hey, mm-hmm. like that there's something here in this moment. And in a lot of times when you give that moment a chance, it does pull you deeper into wonder. In paying attention, it's and sometimes it's disorienting. Like, it's usually not very linear, but it's wondrous nonetheless.
It's wondrous nonetheless. When you were speaking, it just reminded me of Robert Frost's definition of a poem. He said it's a momentary pause, it's not pause, and a momentary stay against confusion.
Mm, I love that. Yeah.
A momentary stay against confusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
And I thought when I first wrote in 76, you know, they said you're going to put poems in the book. Nobody reads poems. I said, no, but if they come, let me just put them in, and you can take them out if they don't. But if they seem to fit, but at the same time, I secretly wished in my heart that it was a way to show people that poems can be read, that they're not just for people who read poetry. But this little thing speaking to me, call it a poem or prayer, whatever you call it, that they would no longer shy away from a book that had poetry in it as well as prose.
Yeah.
So it's all of it is a very organic thing, you know. If you let something unfold, you know, like if I had gotten on that train and I say, well, good, now I'm going to write something about story and yeah. about travel. But I wasn't doing that. I was looking, and I was so taken with what I was looking. I just started, like a scribe, writing down what I was seeing or hearing or feeling. And that's how that sort of thing happens.
Yeah.
And when I saw that first piece of writing in summer, I was really excited. I said, I'll write things that will be a little different than they were at the beginning, but they'll be the same thing in another yeah. voice or another time of my life. Here, I'm almost 80. When I was writing it, I'm 36, 37, whatever. And so something should have happened in between all of that. Mm. If that makes any sense.
It does. It does. And it kind of leads to my one of my final questions is you reflect on your life that you've spent, not only in religious life, but your creative life. I'm just curious, what have you learned about God or life, capital L life, through mm-hmm. creativity? That's another softball question. I know.
Well, that is a softball question, becoming hardball, I think is what it is. But I think what I'm thinking here, the first thing that comes off the top of my head when I look back on my creative life and my life of prayer, which have been joined together from the minute I started writing, I think what I'm most aware of today is how much of our lives is about gift and about not meriting or deserving of things that happen that are marvelous. Something happens and it's a gift of God. And so I am much more daring. I'm writing a new book of poetry now, just trusting the gift. It's coming from the Spirit. It's coming from God, and just let it come and enjoy it and be thankful for it, and try to make it on the page. The Greek word poeta means a maker, and I'm making. And the word a stanza of poetry is an Italian word, stanza. It's a room, and I have this empty room when I look at a page, and I'm going to put furniture in there. I'm going to rearrange it and all of this. So it becomes more of everything coming being a gift, and how would it fit in this picture? Instead of saying, well, that doesn't quite fit now, so I, you know, but let it come and then see what the final, what the outcome is of that. It's the same thing in prayer. If you go in with one intention, or you hope that this is going to be this, and all of a sudden it's anything but what you thought it was going to be, yep. And you're trying to be open to it, and if you receive it as a gift, and then bless it, it will be. And so that's a lot of what I just noticed, that about my last four or five poems have had a lot to do about death. And I say, now where is that coming from, a young guy like me? What is this? What is happening here? But I wouldn't say, well, I better not write that. It might take me somewhere I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? Why would I be afraid to go? It's a great gift. It's a portal into something that might deepen my love of the journey all the way to the end and beyond. So that's kind of what I'm kind of so much aware of right now. And that being so, whenever anything comes, I mean, I practically stop. I'm glad I'm not a race car driver or something, because I'd have to stop the car and write it down. You know, I get up in the middle of the night and I write whatever it is, because it's a gift. It might never come again. And I'm so aware of that. I have been my whole life, but not as poignantly as I do now. When something comes, I don't say, oh, I can't do that. I won't have enough years to even do. I just say, wow, look at this. Let's see where it goes, you know? And so that is, that's been one of the things I've learned.
It's beautiful.
And I've also learned that in one sense, my life, your life, our lives, those who pray, my life is a prayer. It's becoming a prayer. And so is your life and her life and their lives. you know, a life lived sincerely with a longing for God is a prayer.
Yes.
Your life itself. And sometimes you have the time to pray more deeply, or write, or dance, or sing, or paint, or whatever it is. But there's more time than at others. But you're still in the game. You're still the little boy or the little girl who wondered who God is. Mm-hmm. And will I ever see God? Is he an old man? Somebody told me the other day, her little granddaughter, who had knocked the parents of her granddaughter, are unchurched. So she, or another woman, took the little girl to church. She said, "Would you like to go?" And she said, "Oh, yes." And so she goes and she comes into the church. And she said, "Why is that man hanging up there on that cross? Who is that?" And they said, "Well, that's Jesus." And she said, "Oh, no, it's not. Jesus is a baby." That is her God, you know.
Yeah.
I'm above her living. And of course, who God is in each of our lives is much more expansive and profound and deep than what we could even imagine. But if you've continued to pray and continue to try to be in a space where God can find you, God changes.
Yeah.
For you. He's yep. not the God of you know, God, of course, is eternal, but that's nice. Who can connect with that? You know, it's how I experience God now, how I know that God is in my life. I know God is touching me here. You know, sometimes you can even break into tears and you don't know why you're crying. And you could be in church, you could be walking down the street, you could be taking a shower, you know, you just don't know, but there is something that is tremendously important to you that's trying to break through somehow and tell you that it's there and it wants to make friends with you somehow.
Mm.
Or connect with you. So it's like living in the spirit is living in the body. It's who you are right now. I keep over my desk all the time this quote from 1 Corinthians, Paul 15-44. What is sown a physical body is raised a spiritual body. If there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. They're one. And so to live in the spirit is to live in your own skin, in touch with the spirit part of who you are. I don't know why that touches me so, but it does. I guess it's because so throughout my life, in my own life and in other people's lives, I've seen people trying to become spiritual, whatever that means, and they're running away from the body. Or they are trying to become a spirit or something, and they're trying to ascend upward, and God is coming down, becoming incarnate, and we miss each other. Mm. It's so obvious where God is, because we're going up and he's scratching his head coming down. He's going to be a baby. He's going to be a human being. This is the incarnation for Franciscans, is the center of all spirituality, the incarnation of God. God actually becomes human, just like us, except for sin. That's what Paul said. He knew things, you know. He sometimes he sounds like he knows everything, but he doesn't. He really is a writer who you say, where? It's got to come from God. He knows much. And of course, he's writing his epistle to the Romans before the four Gospels were even written.
Sure. Yeah. You know?
And so he really kind of founded Christianity in one sense. But he found language, or language found him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another way of putting it. You know, in the beginning was the Word, but the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, it's like all of those things that tend to separate are not good in my vocabulary. Separate people, separate soul from body, separate, you know, this things which integrate are of God, because if everything is of God. And so to bring all that together in your life, John Keats, writing to his brother once, who lived in Kentucky of all places in America, he was writing to him, and he says that earth, or life on earth, is a veil, of V-A-L-E, a valley, it's a veil of soul making. We're learning to make our souls. It sounds like you don't have a soul, you have to make one. But there is something about accepting that gift that you have a soul. Now, what are you going to do with it? And we see people, we say they're a great soul. What a great soul that person was and is, you know. Like, they have really worked on this gift of God. Their wholeness, their spirit, their body, their goodness, or whatever. And, sorry.
Yeah, that is... And that makes me think of creativity again, where we started, you know, where it's in the spiritual life too. It seems like there is, okay, yes, you are born with the soul, but there's this participatory element to it. Like you are making, you're creating,
yes,
partnering with someone in that creation.
That's
to
right.
Deepen your soul, to become more aware of what's already true within you. Oh, yeah, it's just such a...
That's a good, beautiful way to put it. That's what it is. It's this cooperation, this participatory act of taking this great gift of you, your unique personality, and embracing that and then expanding it by cooperating with God's grace, God's inspiration, God's surprises, you know. And because we spend our whole lives, people like me and you, we spend our whole lives, you know, trying to see God or feel God or know where God is. And every day we're meeting him. I'm meeting God right now. I don't see any other Christ except you, and you're in a screen. I can't even get in there, but I know you. I know you're there in there somewhere. But it's that's where we see God. That's where we become Christ to others. Sorry.
You're fine.
A few years ago, I'll end with this. Because my voice is going. I haven't done sung opera this morning yet to make my opera self. Anyway, I went to Gethsemane Abbey because there was this conference. There you go, you have it. between the Trappists and the Tibetan monks, led by the Dalai Lama, who was doing a return journey to Merton's grave, as Merton made the journey to see the Dalai Lama when he went to Bangkok, where he died, you know. Mm-hmm. That. So they were having this conference, and I had to get there. I didn't know how to lie, chills. Trying to find a Benedictine habit or anything. I said, trying to get into this. and so I called a friend of mine, a Trappist there, Patrick Hart, who had been Merton's secretary. And I said, how can I possibly get into that conference? And he said, well, what I'd suggest is through the press, go to St. Anthony Messenger at that time, the press, and say, could I write an article or something? And I have a press thing too. And that's how I got in. Mm-hmm. I wrote an article for the St. Anthony Messenger and a chapter in one of my books, The Landscape of Prayer. So I'm there, and we were like in a almost a balcony, but it was kind of raised. And then the monks were down in the arena down here, it seemed. And we were just listening and observing. And one day I looked up about 10:30 in the morning, 10. There was a coffee break, bathroom break, or whatever. They took a break. And I was fiddling with something, and I looked up, and everybody was gone except the Dalai Lama, who was sitting down there with the ended up being his bodyguard on the other side. But and I said, God wants me to go down. I have to go down there. I they'll start coming back as soon as I head down there. I know it, but it didn't happen. So I got down there. I didn't even know what I was going to say, but I said, I have to get down there. So I went down and came up to him, and I said, Your Holiness, would you pray with me? That was a total gift. I didn't know I was going to say that or what I was going to do. So, and he said, of course. So he sat down. He took my hand. He was sitting down. I sat down next to him, and he took my hand, looked into my eyes, total silence for about 3 minutes. I had never felt compassion and love at that level coming from another human being through his eyes. Of course, he is in their faith, the reincarnation of the Buddha of compassion.
Yep. Yep.
So, I was just done in. I did manage to get back to my seat. There's more to the story. But what I just recently, I was thinking about that experience. And I had never asked myself, I wonder what he felt coming from me. Did he see Christ? Did he feel my awe in being in his presence? did he feel my love, my compassion? I didn't think of this, but until recently I said, because, you know, it's always a two-way street in one way or another. And I thought, wow, that's how we are present to others.
Yes.
Just by looking with love at somebody. And or if we are making our souls, building our souls, and we're trying to be Christ-like, most probably that's what they'll feel. They won't feel evil. They won't feel hatred or violence. They will feel this soul that we've become, and I'm using that in quotes, you know, so... And it was so strange because I never, now this is the way God works, because I remember now when he left, there were all the monks were lined up, you know, like a belt line or something that you had to run through, and his car was at the end down there, and his car came in. And he rolled the window down, and he looked at everything, and then he looked at me. He looked right at me, and I knew that once again I had to go there. So I walked through all those monks. Said they, I know they thought I was crazy, but I walked through and went right to the car, And he wanted to shake my hand. He looked at me again, and then he left. But so maybe he saw something too, that of himself in me, as I saw something of myself in him. And that's how we make God present to one another.
Mm-hmm.
So that all the prayer we're doing, all the work, all the grace, all the masses, all the sacraments, all this, are so that we can be Christ. We don't have to say, oh, I have to turn Christ on now.
Yeah. But,
you know, when we're present to someone, and that is the R of the word sport, your openness, your response will be to build a soul that's worthy of the other, whoever that other is. It could be somebody who'd like to wring their neck, but you're moved by Christ to be Christ, because that's who you have become. And that was all gift.
Yeah.
I didn't say go to God and say, now make me into Christ, and don't take too long because I'm gonna have a short life or whatever. It happens in the process of being who we are, and with at least a minimum of discipline to try to focus at least once a day on God's love, God's goodness, God's presence, you know. However briefly, because it always grows longer. If you do brief visits, you're going to have longer visits, and you're going to and to use your words, you're going to long for it. Longing will come, and that's what will make the difference.
Yeah, the moral of the Dalai Lama story is that St. Anthony Messenger needs to give you more press passes.
That they're not what? That they what?
I said the St. Anthony Messenger needs to give you more press passes, more assignments. Last time they put you on assignment, you met the Dalai Lama.
I know. And I didn't know whether to sing hello, Dolly, or what, but I ended up asking him to pray, you know.
It's
those kinds of happenings in our life. And thank you for this opportunity to talk about the books.
Oh, it's been awesome.
Spirituality. And, I had a real period in my life where it started at the seminary, where we had teachers who were saying, you know, this is a backstory now. How was your time?
Oh, I'm good. Yeah. I mean, I want to be conscious of your time and your energy, but I'm fine. I'm all ears for as long as you want to talk.
Okay. Well, this then will be the last one. So you know, like one of them would say, you know, you can't, we were teenagers in the mind. You can't have pets. And you can't pet animals and dogs and cats and that because it'll arouse your senses. Teenagers, they're always aroused. What, they don't need cats and...
I said, no, that's...
you know, what were they talking about? But I got so scared. And I had my Sally, my dog. Oh, God, I love my Sally.
And was this said when you were in school? I think I missed something.
I was a teenager at the high school seminary in Mount Healthy.
Okay, gotcha.
And so we got to go home for Christmas. Well, I only got home because I had to ride a bus. So I was home 4 days and the rest I was 3 days on each side on the bus. You know?
Yeah. Anyway,
and I was lying in bed first night and there in my room and my dog Sally came in and I was afraid to pet her.
Hmm.
So what a good dog. And then I just went. And then when I came back in the summer, she was dead. Hmm. And that kind of spirituality, I fought against that for years, you know, because it got somehow in my system.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to pull out of all of that. We still have friars and have those kinds of fears.
Mm.
You're young. You got to be careful what you say to young people. Well, the guy was nuts anyway. But anyway, so that was the thing that I found words for.
Yeah. Hmm.
It was really, and I might read you the poem, but if I can't get
through, yeah,
it's a hard one for me to read, but I think it was in the, its book is called A Far Country Near, Poems New and Selected. So the new ones were Far Country Near. It might have been right where I thought it was. You see why they have first lines at the end of collected works and all that. God must not want me to read this poem. I don't know Earth Muse at Midnight. I don't think that's a very early book. Visions and Revisions. It could be in that one.
Or maybe God really wants you to read the poem because we've been playing with these themes of waiting throughout our whole conversation.
Right. I'm going to have to work at this.
Yeah, exactly.
The discipline of looking at every single poem. Oh, my. Sunday with Julian. Oh, that's a fun. Julian of Norwich. That's a fun poem. But now, complaint to the sea, the shiver of tons of fun. This is very strange. It should be on visiting the home of Henry James. Here it is. I kept looking for on. It's while visiting the home of Henry James in Rye. He was called, you know, by other writers, the master. So the master in here is James, not Jesus. But while visiting the theme of Henry James in Rye, My dog, Sally, the Springer Spaniel of my childhood, just bounded down the street outside Lamb House. That's his home. And I saw my dog. I mean, it was a real dog, but just like my dog. Where I'm reading Denise Levertov, waiting for Henry James to open the door, the master of whom Levertov writes, then I quote her, "Remember James rehearsing over and over his theme, the loss of innocence and the attainment, note by separate note, sounding its tone, until by accretion a chord resounds of somber understanding." What a summary of James. Like my dog Sally, appearing so many years after my loss of innocence, and me seeing her and finally understanding, not somberly, but with a rueful smile, that things recur and we can bless what we dismissed, like the childhood dog we outgrew, or in my case, gave up for a pseudo god who disappeared years later, so that I want to run after someone else's dog, embrace her, and say, "I'm sorry, I did not understand, lost my innocence to a false, repressive religion that frowned on petting and cuddling animals. I now embrace to refine the innocent god of my childhood. Gentle Sally, hear my prayer, as now I enter James's dining room and walk out in the sunlit garden, where I bury you at last, in the southwest corner of James's garden at Lamb House, where the master buried his own dogs, and where these elegiac lines try to render the tone of the spreading mulberry tree, the dog like Sally and me." Tone is everything in Henry James' play, but he uses that word over and over again. What is
that?
So, just, you know, I thought of that when you were talking about your spirituality, you know, a fundamentalist, and then and you were a creator of the world. What were your next something? All the things you went until you finally rediscovered you.
Yeah. And it, I appreciate you sharing that story about Sally and reading the poem. I mean, it's a beautiful but also heartbreaking poem. But then it's so crazy for me to think about your journey of, like, there was a time when you were afraid to pet this dog you love, and yet now all your poems are so sensory.
I know.
It's like you're petting Sally with each poem.
I know. Oh boy. Is that ever true? And that is a good description of my poetry, sensory. You know, I try to be anyway, because it's always talked about that there's a spiritual body, there's a physical body, there's a spiritual body, you know, all of this that is a part of integration.
Yes.
In psychological terms, but no matter what the terms, the experience is the same, that we achieve a certain amount of integrity in the sense of integration of all of these seemingly opposing ideas or opposing feelings, opposing sights and sounds or whatever. So anyway,
thank you. This has been so fun. Thank
you, and I'm glad. I hope there's something there you can use, or if not, at least you know, it's something you can laugh about and move by from time to time and whatever.
I'm sure there's plenty we can use here.
Again, that was Father Murray Bodo. His new book, God's Love Song, The Vision of Francis and Claire, which he co-authored with Susan St. Singh, is available in the Franciscan Media Store at shop.franciscanmedia.org. And the refresh of Song of the Sparrow, Four Seasons of Prayer, will be released August 2024. It's a beautiful and honest book that really invites readers into the rhythm of a disciplined lifestyle of prayer, even through seasons of life that are filled with waiting. If you enjoyed this conversation, I think you'll really enjoy the book. Huge thanks again to Father Murray for being on the Off the Page podcast from Franciscan Media, and thanks as well to Father Cyprian Concilio for providing the music for this episode. I encourage you to check his music out on Spotify or wherever you listen to your music. This is Stephen Copeland signing off. Peace and all good.
I will lead you into the desert with me and tenderly speak to your